The frogs.
Bollocks.
Hi.
Hello, howdy doody.
Oh, I've got... forgot about this.
Forgot about
howdy
what?
Howdy doody.
Howdy doody, folks. How's it going?
Oh, it's...
Oh, I'm going to Australian. Going down under.
Oh, that's disgusting.
I promise you an accent at the start of every episode, and there you go. That was Australian,
if you
couldn't tell.
I promise you I'd try to stop it, and I failed you. I'm so sorry you had to listen to that.
I can keep on going if you want.
No,
you want
please.
A koala and a shrimp on the barbie?
It's terrible. Such a bad accent.
I'm really sorry to any Australians out there. Can only apologise.
Awful.
I think it's got to that time of the day when I'm beginning to lose my mind.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's kind of that time when we're all just feeling a little bit loopy.
A bit loopy, and don't mind making an absolute prat of myself.
As per usual.
I do tend to do that. Okay, so what have you been up to?
I've been doing some wildlife filming, which is obviously my job. I don't know how much I can really say at this stage. It's not really embargoed or NDA'd or anything. It's just I don't want to give anything away for upcoming series and shows.
Yes, that may be about the season.
Maybe. But yeah, no, it's been really nice. Some successes, some failures, but that's ultimately how the cookie crumbles with wildlife. Mm. Sometimes they do exactly what you want them to do and all the research has sort of suggested they will do. And then sometimes they do the complete opposite. And that's just how it goes with filming wildlife.
But you just never know, do you, until you're actually there with the camera in those conditions, knowing what it's like. And sometimes it can just take forever and ever.
Yeah, and
it's
ever.
It's long.
Very long time.
Sometimes I just don't know how you do it.
Well, that's one thing. A lot of people say, like, how do you have the patience to sit and hide for days, weeks, months at a time? And quite honestly, it's quite easily, because often, even if you're looking for a target species that doesn't turn up, there's often other things to look at.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you're out and about and you're in nature, and it's lovely. You can just kind of be with nature and you can witness things that normally you wouldn't be able to see if it wasn't for you hiding away, you know?
Yeah, totally see that. And having been your assistant a couple of times before, I can definitely appreciate it. It's when it takes months and you're in uncomfortable situations. That is when I have the utmost respect for any wildlife filmmakers out there, because I just know how much it takes to be able to do that, and like mental resilience to be able to, get cramp in your leg and be able to stay still or not react when you see an animal, because you can't, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, that's it. I think I really want to be screaming when I get the shot. I really want to be going, yes, oh my God, look at that amazing behavior.
Mm.
But no, you've got to just focus. You've got to just be steady, be relaxed, get the shot, get it in focus, get the sequence. And then only kind of retrospectively can you kind of get excited by it. Because I remember the first time I saw orangutan in Sumatra, and I had these kind of preconceptions of what that experience would be like. And it was really strange because I got there and we were seeing this really old male, and I just wanted to be giddy and just kind of jump up and down and go, wow, look at this. This is one of the top wildlife encounters you can have. But ultimately, I had to just focus. I had to be really calm, really steady, focus on the shot. And again, like I said, retrospectively, I was really excited. But in the moment, I just had to focus on the job. And it's kind of weird way around to do it. But, that's why we kind of do the other work that we do with science communication. We put the cameras away and we talk about nature. We do surveys, we do guiding, and sharing that kind of love for nature is also a really great way to get excited by it.
Yeah, we save our excitement for opportunities like chatting on a podcast.
Exactly.
Where we can jump up and down and go, oh my God, it's an orangutan. Because obviously you wouldn't do that in front of an orangutan for the orangutan's sake as much as yours.
Oh, we could take the podcast on the road, though. We can go to Sumatra.
Yeah.
Do a podcast episode from Sumatra.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Sponsors out there. We need you.
Goodness. James, you are absolutely shameless.
But no, what have you been up to?
Well, filming with you, actually. Spending a lot of time with you.
I know, it's been great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Working together.
Yes, it's been lovely.
How rude. You also at home couldn't see the eye roll that she just did then.
I didn't do an eye roll.
You did?
I didn't.
You did?
I actually did not.
You did. It's been great working with you.
Yeah, but I was only teasing you.
I mean.
I've had a lovely time, lovely time. No, it's been good because we had our first proper film together. We worked together, obviously, a lot on the podcast and doing various different bits of filming for charities and things. but it was our first proper BBC shoot together where you were behind the camera and I was awkwardly stood in front of it, like I am most of the time.
Not awkward at all. Wonderful. It should be a very, very nice sequence that will come out later on this year.
A really important story, I think. So that will be on the upcoming Spring Watch, which it's exciting when it's this time of year because the team starts getting back together again, ideas start floating around, and you start to see things moving in that direction. So I'm excited. What the fact?
For this week's What the Fact, the theme is mating.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So we had offspring last week, so it's only fitting that we then talk about mating.
Yeah.
And it's an important episode because, sadly, I'm now losing. You've snuck into the lead.
Look, I can't deny last week my fat was just better.
I don't think it was. Yours just involved sexier animals. You had orcas versus gnats. It's not a fair fight.
Not just gnats, but fungus gnats.
Yeah, it's hard to convince people of fungus gnats. And quite honestly, I'm disappointed.
No, I love fungus gnats. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, orca is going to slightly trump it, I think, in that case. But I was thinking back of everything we've done so far. I was thinking back, you know, based on the animals that you and I have comparatively picked, I've gone for things a bit like orca, I've gone for bats, and you've gone, well, probably the most sexy animal that you've chosen is a mallard.
Hey, mallards are sexy.
No, they are, don't
get
me wrong.
A very seductive quack. Gotta love a randy mallard, even though they're bastards.
Those randy bastards. If you don't know what we're on about, go back and listen to the previous episode.
Yeah, the Henry VIII of ducks.
Yeah, literally. But no, it's quite funny. It says a lot about us.
Yeah, I don't go for the kind of the obvious sexy stuff. I dine out on the kind of the cool science rather than rely on sex appeal.
Hang on a minute, I've gone for the like the small underdog as well. Mixed it up a little bit.
Mixed and matched, yeah, fair enough. I should take a leaf out of your book and go sexy for this week, but I definitely have not.
Oh no.
My animal is very unsexy. We're talking about mating, so we thought, oh, we could make it a bit more sexy for this episode.
La la.
But no. My one is super unsexy. So should I go first?
I think with that build up, you better.
Okay. Now you're about to be very impressed because I've gone for a multi-themed fact that encompasses not just the current theme, but most of our previous themes as well.
Is this a... You keep doing this. You keep pulling multiple rabbits out of the hat.
Yeah, but I can. I'm clever.
I've done a clever
strategy. I've got a clever story. I'm wanting to up the game. I'm wanting to make it harder. So I thought, let's encompass many, many themes, but it's not very sexy.
Okay. Go on.
So many of us have seen the animal that I'm going to talk about, the anglerfish. Do you remember where you've seen one?
Are you going to say some personal insult here?
No.
Something. Where I've seen an anglerfish. Well, I've seen many anglerfish and they've always been pickled in jars.
Oh. Well, that's not where most people have seen it. Most people have seen anglerfish and Finding Nemo.
Oh. Oh, you went for the lovely childhood, beautiful one. Yeah. Yes, Finding Nemo. I thought you meant literal anglerfish, which I've seen at the Natural History Museum preserved.
No, this is obviously on the very scientific film Finding Nemo. You know, the scene where the goggles that they have with the important address on it gets dropped down into the depths and Dory and Nemo swim down to find it.
Just keep swimming. Just
do you remember what the address was, by the way? This is a good Pixar
42
fact.
Wallaby Way, Sherburton, Sydney.
That was a...
42 Wallaby Way... P. Sherman, 42 Wallaby Way, Sydney.
Correct.
Damn it.
P. Sherman, 42 Wallaby Way, Sydney. But as they're going to find the goggles, they get distracted by this glowing blue light, transfixed. They sort of follow it around, unaware of the large, sort of pointy-toothed creature that it belongs to, the anglerfish. Pixar's animation of an anglerfish isn't really far off, but there are over 300 species, all living in deep sea, somewhere between 200 to 300 metres deep. Now, a lot of the species have some form of lure to catch its prey. Some are often mimicking, you know, small fish or crustaceans. Notice the mimicry theme there.
Okay.
others have this ability to glow, as in the case of Finding Nemo. And this glowing is actually in itself scientifically incredible because that glow the anglerfish can't really create it itself. It relies entirely on this symbiotic relationship where it uses these bioluminescent bacteria, and that's what creates the glow, which lures its prey in. But it's thought also this glowing light could also be used to help find a mate. Now, this lure is only present on females. The males look entirely different. Anglerfish have this immense sexual dimorphism, which basically means that males and females can look very different, both in their structure, in their size, in their physiology. And in the case of anglerfish, the males can be absolutely minute, only millimeters long. In fact, one species is potentially breaking the record for the smallest vertebrate. And wow. Yeah, only about 6.7 millimeters, I think it is.
So that's tiny for a
vertebrate. Absolutely tiny. Whereas the females, on the other hand, could be 10 times, 50 times bigger than the males. So there's a big difference in size. So males are minute compared to the females. In many anglerfish cases, reproduction happens in quite a normal kind of fishy way, where the female releases her eggs into the water and the male releases his sperm in order for fertilization to occur. However, in the suborder group of anglerfish called Ceratiodae, Ceratiodae, yep. Ceratiodae, mating happens in an incredibly peculiar way. Now, when you're a young anglerfish, you go through many changes. For the female, they obviously get larger, they grow sharp, ferocious teeth, and allure, and that helps them capture and eat their prey. However, for the males, as they get older, they don't do much growing. They lose their normal teeth and instead grow either tiny teeth or this beak-like structure, which is completely useless for catching its prey. In fact, their sole focus in life at this point becomes finding a female.
Which is hard to do in the deep sea because it's pitch black. And resources are sparse, which means finding mates is incredibly difficult because you don't often come across one another.
Exactly. But for what they lack in stature, they make up for in scent detections. Because as you say, it's incredibly sparse in the deep sea. So their ability to sniff out their female, the pheromones emitted by that female, they've got this incredible sense which enables them to do so, enables them to find a female. Once the male has caught up with her, he instantly and instinctively bites onto her so tight that it's impossible to let go. Now, this is where it gets super crazy. The male's mouth releases these enzymes, which basically start to break down his mouth and also the female's skin where they're in contact with each other. And eventually it causes them both to fuse together. And this is how they will remain for basically the rest of their lives, eternally fused.
Oh, gosh, that's amazing.
Now, this fusion not only binds their bodies, but it also binds their blood vessels. In fact, most of the male's body atrophies, you know, it withers away and becomes entirely dependent on gaining nutrients from the female through this fusion of blood vessels. And that's obviously where the theme blood comes in.
Okay, there you go.
Clever. The couple joined at the hip, quite literally, well, mouth to hip, are then side by side for whenever the female releases her eggs, the male's there and he can release his sperm and fertilization is basically guaranteed. That's why they do this, is because it's so dark in the big depths of the deep sea that by binding themselves together, they're ready for whenever the female releases her eggs, the male can just be there ready.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? Eliminates that stress or concern that you're not going to find the eggs in time or find her in time.
Well, you say that. A lot of males that don't find her will just die. Like I said, those teeth kind of become so small that they're useless for catching their prey that if they don't find a female, they're incapable of feeding.
Oh, what a way to go. They've got such a sad existence. Either die of starvation because you haven't found a female or latch onto one and be engulfed by her.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure which one I'd prefer.
Now, it might just be one male that fuses to one female, but in many cases, many males might end up fusing to her. Sometimes up to 8 males, which is...
What a lot of effort for her there. Carrying around 8 men. Jesus.
Yeah. An immense effort. And this is a form of sexual parasitism. Notice the parasitic.
Okay.
And this sexual parasitism is basically in order to feed off of her and be there to release his sperm when she releases her egg. So it's absolutely incredible. Now, this process of fusing is enabled because anglerfish don't have an adaptive immune system. So when our immune system is incredibly adaptive, and whenever we get something that's foreign, our white blood cells can react quickly and get rid of it. And most vertebrates have this kind of system. But for anglerfish, they aren't able to do this at all. So it's what enables their bodies to just fuse together. They don't have that immune defense that enables them to fight against this foreign, you know, thing that's trying to get onto her body. And that basically enables them to fuse together. Now, the exact science of all of this is still unknown because they live in such deep scenarios. It's quite hard to collect specimens and you don't want to be doing that really. But what's weird is obviously the anglerfish's immune system is still suitable for defending itself from disease and other organisms in the sea. You know, it's not just floating around binding to everything. It should become very heavy and just sink to the bottom of the Mariana Trench or whatever. Mm. So how its immune system kind of selectively fuses to males is all a bit of a mystery. But yeah, how about that? Mating where you fuse yourself to your partner.
That's a really cool example. A very, very good one. And the deep sea to me is just fascinating because it's so alien and so weird. And I think that's a prime example. But do you know what's quite funny?
What?
So when we decided upon the mating theme, the first thing that came to my head was anglerfish.
And that's because it deserves to win. It's super cool.
It is super cool. But I just had this niggling feeling in the back of my head that you might do it.
Oh, really?
I don't know because it is just such a great bit of science.
Yeah. It's totally unique in the kind of the mating world. Yeah. Where else can you fuse your bodies together in such a bizarre way? It's just, like I said, it's not very sexy. In fact, it's probably a little bit gross.
It's quite sexy. It's sexy science.
Sexy science, not sexy behaviour.
Yeah, no, it's not. Anglerfish aren't particularly the most attractive animals.
No.
At all. In fact, probably quite the opposite. Mm. Which is why I've got a bit of a soft spot for them. Because, you know, I quite like ugly things.
That's the second week in a row where it's been damning for me. Thank you so much.
I was taking
a sip of water. I almost choked.
I was saying it because I was looking at you as I said that, but I didn't mean that. I mean, like, honestly, like animals that are deceived, like animals that are thought to be attractive.
Digging that hole.
You are very handsome.
Uh-huh.
You're very handsome. Uh-huh. I'm not talking
about
you. You
can't look me in the eye now, can you? You cannot look me in the eye.
I didn't mean that. I promise.
I'm free to a good home. Anyone out there?
Stop it. You're very handsome. I'm very sorry. I did mean anglerfish.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I like anglerfish. So.
Oh, go on then. Give us your facts.
I'm very sorry.
Dig yourself out this hole.
Okay. I do think yours was pretty good. Pretty good. And I think it's going to be tough for me to be able to beat it. I hold my hands up when I'm confident and I hold my hands up when I'm not so sure that I will win. And this may be one of those cases.
Excellent.
But it's still good. I have gone for what is a traditionally attractive animal, or an animal that, again, people really love. And it's a little bit similar to the last episode.
Leopard slug.
Not leopard slug, no. But I've gone down a similar cetacean theme.
Okay.
Or more particular dolphin theme.
Oh, they are randy bastards.
Everything to you is a randy bastard.
Oh, but they are. Mallards and dolphins are up there for the randiest.
Well, just you wait for this. So, female dolphins have evolved a secret weapon in the sexual arms race that they are in constant competition with their male counterparts.
Okay.
Penises and vaginas across the animal kingdom vary in shapes and sizes. As you know, we've spoken about mallards with their corkscrew penis.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a type of bat that has a penis that's shaped like a heart.
Oh, there you go. Get that for your Valentine's cards for next year.
Could you imagine? Yeah. You could walk into Tesco and you see
it. I'm definitely going to make you one for Valentine's next year.
Oh, great. Well, I didn't get a card this year, so that'll be nice. Yeah.
I'll make it up to you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very, very much for that. But whilst, of course, there's this diversity in penis shape, there is also diversity in vaginas. But very sadly, this type of science massively lacks. So our understanding of female anatomy, female sexual anatomy, is nowhere near as advanced as it is for males. But Dara Obark at the Dalhousie University in Canada is trying to change that, especially by looking at dolphin genitalia.
Mm.
Or cetaceans in general, but that's her main you know, field of interest. And she's found that there is this unparalleled level of vaginal diversity that she had no idea existed before her research began in marine mammals. Now, marine mammal vaginas typically have a lot of folds in it, a lot of complex spirals as well. So the shapes typically are quite contorted. Mm. And they originally thought that this was because when copulation happened with the male, it made it tricky for the salt water to come into contact with the sperm, because that could impact the survival of the sperm and therefore, you know, inhibit the pregnancy later on.
Yeah.
So they thought that was maybe the idea about having a complex vagina, but turns out that they're not entirely sure that's true, or it's not necessarily the case for all species. It could be partly, but there is also other things at play.
Mm.
Now, she made silicon molds of vaginas from cetaceans, whales and dolphins and porpoises that had sadly washed ashore due to stranding incidents. So making the most of these bodies by, you know, using them for science.
Mm.
So she made these molds of common dolphin, common seal, actually, so not just cetaceans, but a pinniped too, as well as common porpoise and bottlenose dolphin. And she found some differences between these four species. Now, the vagina of the common dolphin and the common seal seemed to be relatively simple in comparison to the others, meaning it was perhaps more amenable to penetration.
Okay.
So it was
amenable to penetration.
Yeah. Okay. So it was easier for a male to penetrate than the others. And these silicon molds demonstrated, of course, not only the complexity of the vagina, but also, you know, when a penis enters, at which angle is best for penetration, which position might be better to have a successful pregnancy. So she tested all sorts of wonderful and weird things with these molds, just to understand how these female anatomies worked. But then with the common porpoise and bottlenose dolphin, they found extensive vaginal folds that actually obstructed penis entry. Now, male bottlenose dolphins form alliances together that can be between two or four individuals strong, and these alliances keep competitors away from the females that they want to protect and mate with. And when the females are kind of confronted with this group of males that are in an alliance, they have little choice actually about who they can mate with. So it's dolphin sex can be at times a little bit forceful.
Sure.
So they have to end up mating with quite a lot in their pod. So the thought is that by having these vaginal folds, it gives her some decision making. It gives her some agency. So whilst copulation is taking place, if she turns a little bit around mm-hmm. and puts herself in not the optimum position for a pregnancy, the male won't know any other difference and actually will ejaculate into a fold and not into the vagina itself.
Interesting.
So she's got a complicated vagina essentially to trick the males and to make sure that her precious egg isn't fertilised by a male suitor that she doesn't deem acceptable.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And that's all to do with just the body position for
body position and of course the folds and the complexity of her vagina. She's able to be able to do that.
Right.
So it's this argument between, are you behaviourally able to kind of choose a suitor and get the others to back off? Or if you can't, what can your biology do to choose the suitor and choose the sperm? So it's thought that with, you know, the common dolphin and the common seal can be more easily penetrated, perhaps their behaviour is able to make that choice. Whereas for these other species, the common porpoise and the bottlenose dolphin, they rely more on their anatomy to use that choice and select the sperm.
Interesting. So for the porpoise and for the bottlenose, they are more frisky with their methods, and therefore the females, you know, rely on the ability to block passage.
Yeah.
Whereas for the common dolphin and the common seal, it's the behavioral choices which end up mm-hmm. passing on the genetics.
Yeah. Yeah, which is really interesting. But then research goes a little bit further. And there is another brilliant researcher, Patricia Brennan. I love that females are studying female genital. Mm. It seems to be a really big female-dominated science yeah. thing, as perhaps you might expect. And she's been looking into clitoris in dolphins. This is just an additional cherry on top
sort
of fact. Because in terms of the debate about whether clitoris evolved for any reproductive reason, whether it evolved for pleasure, is still ongoing. And as you can imagine, it gets quite heated actually in that debate. And there are lots of critics of it.
Sure.
Perhaps, which is a real shame, and there is still a lot of working on equality to be done within science.
Yeah.
And understanding. But anyway, Patricia has been studying clitoris in dolphins, which she has found when doing postmortems, and the clitoris in dolphins is so large with really, really big nerve endings, free nerve endings, in fact, under the skin, which all indicates that they evolved for pleasure. So we know that perhaps bonobos do this. They've got quite a similar clitoral structure to humans, as you might expect. We're very closely related species. So we think humans, bonobos, have clitoris for pleasure. But now we also think dolphins do as well, which would explain why, as you said earlier, they are so randy. They can be seen having sex all throughout the year. Females will have sex with each other. They will use their fins to rub each other's clitorises. They will use all sorts, actually, their snouts as well.
Yeah, well, they're one of the few other species that we know of that have sex recreationally, not just for the case of breeding and reproducing,
exactly.
But
not
for
when
recreation.
They're in season.
Yeah,
exactly. Males will do it as well. It's not just the females that will have sex with each other. Yeah. There's lots of homosexuality within nature, and dolphins are a really good example of that. But I just love the fact that, you know, we're talking about female pleasure in dolphins through the evolution of a clitoris. I mean, this is something we wouldn't have spoken about 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. It's
okay,
cool.
I've changed my reincarnation again.
Oh, God. James.
The third time on the podcast.
I mean, you're a male human. You don't have it too badly on that regard.
No, this is very true.
But no, I thought that was pretty cool science, actually. It's, you know, I like empowering female science.
Yeah. No, it's amazing that the combination of physiology and behavioral sciences, that's what makes, you know, our kind of study area so fascinating. There are so many avenues to explore when it comes to nature science. You've managed to encompass two of them. So that's brilliant.
But it's great, and it's the combination that really makes things exciting. And especially for an animal that's marine like this, that you're never going to get to really understand how their reproduction works, apparently, until you make a silicon mold of things. But it's great. Modern science is fascinating.
Brilliant. So there you go. So what do you prefer? Do you prefer deep sea sex fusion or shallow sea sex confusion?
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
yeah, I like that. I like that. Both very valid, I think. They're both good ones this week.
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be tight. So as always, we'll put our polls on Twitter. Vote for who you think is the winner. And come on, I need this. I need to narrow that gap again.
Oh, come on, I need this.
No, you don't.
I do. Thank you so much to everybody who has been sending in their questions. There's some really fun ones coming in, but I've got one which is short and sweet from Gabby Wildlife, and she asks, if you had an animal superpower, what would it be?
Loads. There are so many. There are so many animals with amazing abilities that I would love to have. I mean, the boring answer is I'd love to fly.
That's one everyone says.
It's kind of like, would you like to fly or be invisible, of which both, you know, the animal kingdom can do both, like with your glass frogs and other things. So I'd probably go for a swift. I'd like to fly like a swift because they're the fastest bird in horizontal flight. A lot of people think, peregrine's the fastest bird, but I mean, gravity is using most of the work.
It's when they're hunting and swooping down is when they hit those speeds, isn't it? It's not just an ordinary flight.
No, that's it. Whereas swifts, they can fly. They're the fastest in horizontal flight, and it's over 60, nearly 70 miles per hour. So it's an immense speed to achieve by quite small birds. So that's what my superpower would be, to be as fast and as agile as a swift, and then I'll feel like Superman.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I'm going to go sort of similar in terms of how broad yours is, but very opposite in terms of environment. I would probably like to be efficient under the water. So I would love to be able to breathe. First of all, that's quite important.
Underwater.
Underwater. But I'd like to be able to dive, you know, maybe have some built-in flippers.
Yeah.
You know, be able to swim well and breathe underwater. You know, I want to breach. I want to...
Okay.
You know, I want to jump out of the water. I want to dive down to the deeps. I want to see things.
You want to be the Little Mermaid.
I do. I want to be Ariel. Well, she was my favourite.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to do that. I just find the marine world so interesting because it is just so bizarre and different.
Yeah. A sailfish would be good. The fastest fish in the sea.
You just want to be fast.
I just want to be fast. Yeah, because I'm pretty slow on land.
Whereas I just want to be nosy in a different environment and take a look.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. That's a good one, though. I like that.
But a lovely story sent in to us by Joanne Arnold. She says, when we were in Algonquin National Park near Toronto, we went for a final paddle at dusk across a lake. It was just us and one of the boat. Something caught our eye, and as we got closer, we saw a bear running along the beach.
Wow.
We were all delighted. And to cap it all, we paddled closer to shore, and a stunning wolf walked quietly to the water's edge and started lapping. Our minds were blown. We paddled back to our camp and over dinner casually mentioned what we'd seen. Our tour guide wouldn't believe us. He was convinced we were winding him up. Later that night, a haunting wolf howl started across the lake. It was so close the hairs on our necks stood up. The guide turned to us and said, "You bastards, I've been leading camping tours here for 15 years and I've never seen a wolf." She also says, in England, we were walking in the February snow in Norfolk when a barn owl caught our eye. We sat down and watched it quartering the field for a good 45 minutes. It was so close and so stunning, such a treat to see. What made these two encounters especially poignant was that our son had just passed away at a week old. The barn owl appeared a couple weeks later and the wolf a few months later. I like to think of the animal world as being kind to us when we really needed it. Barn owls used to be thought of as spirits of people who had passed on, so it was completely fitting. Now, Joanne, we're incredibly sorry to hear of the passing of your son, but we want to thank you so much for sharing your story. You know, we hear quite a few stories like this of where wildlife has sort of come out at many people's times of need, and I think it is very poignant. And I think, you know, the importance of wildlife and wildlife encounters during our most vulnerable times can't be overlooked. We speak many times about the importance of wildlife on our mental health and well-being, and it's stories like this that are sort of testament to that. You know, I myself have got, you know, a story very similar where I had, you know, sadly lost one of my best friends only a few years ago to a motorcycle accident, and it was only a few days later that I was climbing a mountain by myself, and it was it was incredibly snowy. The snow was coming down and it was a blizzard and many people were turning back, but I knew where I was going and I carried on, and it was all, you know, all safe. And I was very, very sad and in grief, and the snow had cleared, the blizzard had cleared, and just on the top of this mountain was me and this mountain hare. There was no one else around, just me and this mountain hare. And just for a moment I had this kind of sense of peace at a time of immense grief, you know, losing my best friend, and just to have this moment eye to eye with a mountain hare, it kind of had that sense of spirit. And, you know, even for a moment it just completely lifted my spirits. And yeah, like you said, it's poignant and it means something, and all of us can take something away from nature. It's free and it's always there for us. So anybody listening at home, if you're going through a difficult time, I encourage you to go out, go listen to the birdsong, go find your space in nature, because it's always there and it's always there to listen and just to be there for you.
Yeah, I think that's a really lovely thing. And it's like, and it's wonderful, you know, I've never lost somebody that close to me. I mean, grandparents and things, but never a child or a best friend. And I think, you know, to be able to come and talk about that is really important. And it's remarkable the power that nature can have on just us feeling better, brighter, more uplifted. You know, you feel that on a day-to-day walk, but especially at a time like that when you really need it, it's there for you in the most magical way, and it really is just the best escapism you could ask for. Our special guest for this episode is Rod Downey. Now, Rod is the Interim Director of Science at WWF UK, and he leads the Polar Programme. So he spends a lot of his time very isolated in remote regions, studying the Arctic, the Antarctic, and all of its inhabitants.
Amazing.
So he's got a very varied career and some really interesting insights.
Hello, my name's Rod Downey. I lead the Polar Programme for WWF, based in the UK, and I've actually been working in the polar regions for, gosh, more than 25 years, which makes me feel a little bit old, but yeah, about a quarter of a century, initially at the British Antarctic Survey, and now with WWF. Our polar regions really are such amazing places. They're vast, they're remote, they can be unforgiving, but they are astonishingly beautiful. Every field trip that I've done has been different, whether I've been out designing protected areas or monitoring penguin populations, capturing drone imagery of walrus or doing genetic mark recapture studies on polar bears. But my favourite species, without a shadow of doubt, is krill. Antarctic krill, the mighty krill, what we refer to as the superheroes of the Southern Ocean. They're the centre of the food web above the ocean floor in the Southern Ocean. They're the reason why humpback whales migrate thousands of miles every year to spend the austral summer in the Southern Ocean. If you look at the blue whale, largest animal ever to have lived on our planet, bigger than the dinosaurs, yet it's almost entirely dependent on krill for its survival. But not only is it an amazingly important food source for marine mammals and penguins and other seabirds, but it also, krill has this incredible capacity to draw down carbon. And it does that by feeding on vast quantities of phytoplankton on the ocean surface. And then by pooing and by shedding its exoskeleton, it deposits this carbon into the deep ocean. It locks it away for long periods of time. So it draws down. There was a recent study, actually, which showed that it can draw down and store the equivalent of the UK's domestic carbon emissions annually. So year on year, krill are drawing down about the same amount of carbon as we're emitting in the UK. And of course, you know, that helps helps us to tackle climate change. But, you know, krill themselves are incredibly vulnerable to climate change. We know their range is shrinking, their range is contracting polewards, but they're climate heroes in their own right. So that is why I absolutely love the mighty krill. Throughout my career, I've seen and witnessed personally some massive changes in the polar regions. They're changing very fast and in so many ways. And much of this is driven by our global climate crisis. But perhaps it's the loss of sea ice, which has been very well documented in the Arctic, of course, which is probably the single most visible sign of climate change on our planet. And we've lost about half of Arctic sea ice during the period of the satellite record, so going back to about 1978. In the Antarctic, it's been a different picture. Up until about 2015, there was really no discernible major trend, perhaps a slight increase, which is surprising in the Antarctic. But from 2015 onwards, sea ice in the Southern Ocean has just fallen off a cliff edge. We've seen this substantive decline leading up to the record low that we've seen in 2023. It's just dropped off the scale. It's gone bonkers. It's certainly like nothing that I've witnessed in the quarter of a century that I've been working in the Antarctic. And this loss of sea ice has immense consequences, not only for Arctic people, not only for wildlife that lives in the polar regions, but for all of us, for all of humanity, because our polar regions act like this global thermostat. They help us to regulate global temperatures, predominantly by reflecting the sun's energy back out to space. So what we're doing as we approach this tipping point of sea ice is that we're replacing this bright white reflective surface with the dark blue of the ocean as the sea ice melts. And of course, dark colours absorb more heat, so that further warms the planet, and that's even more bad news for our planet as a whole. Now, for many people, the polar regions often seem, you know, they're out of sight, they're out of mind. So, you know, why should we care about them? Well, the reason that we should care about our polar regions is precisely because of how they are so closely connected to the rest of the planet. They help to regulate climate and indeed weather. They regulate climate through this albedo effect by reflecting the sun's energy back out. They also store a lot of carbon in the form of methane in the permafrost. Our polar regions help to drive deep water oceanic circulation. They help to drive atmospheric circulation. And we see the positioning of the jet stream and how that affects our weather, even here in the UK. And crucially, they help to regulate sea levels and effectively the shape of our coastlines and the shape of our continents. There's so many meters, perhaps 70 meters of sea level rise locked up, you know, sea level rise potential locked up in the ice in our polar regions. And put simply, if we continue to break the polar regions, then we don't stand a chance in hell of tackling climate change globally and of helping to nurture and to restore nature across the rest of our planet. So really, we all need to care about what's happening in the polar regions, because what happens there doesn't stay there.
God, I'm so jealous of his work. To be able to work in the polar regions, you know, I'm yet to go. I'd love to go. You know, we kind of experience it mildly in Scotland, you know, the cold climate. But to be able to go to these kind of true wildernesses of these polar regions is just incredible. I'm very, very envious.
Yeah, he's had a very cool career. I've been lucky to go, but to live and work there is just a whole different realm. And to just come face to face with a polar bear, hungry male polar bear like he did, was amazing. When I saw one, it was a white speck in the distance running as fast as it could away from our ship, because where we were at the time was a place where they were historically hunted, so they run. But you know, to be in the heart where they haven't had that persecution, and to really, I don't know, see them like that is pretty epic. But yeah, big up krill though. How cool are they?
God, yeah. I mean, think of all the animals out there that rely entirely on krill, and obviously the food chain that comes after that as well. It's just, yeah, amazing. This tiny little thing supports so much life.
Yeah, and so important for the climate.
Yeah, these polar regions, like he says, they're so important for our combat when it comes to climate change. And these are massive indicators of what's happening in the world. And yes, yeah, it's down to people like Rod that are monitoring these areas that we are learning so much about our impacts and the warming climate.
Yeah, they're often hit the hardest, aren't they? Because that's often what we talk about, is glacier retreat in the Arctic, or, you know, ice melt in the Antarctic and all of that kind of thing. And we think of Antarctica and the Arctic when we think of climate change, you know, that iconic picture of a polar bear on a melting iceberg. And it absolutely is there. And it's so important to be able to understand more about this research and obviously how climate change is not only impacting there, but will then impact the rest of the planet. Right, so we are coming to the end of episode 6, but it's the time that we give a helpful tip, suggestion, something you can do to help protect biodiversity, or, you know, make it a little bit greener in your part of the world. And the tip that we've come up with this time is perhaps one that has, well, a lot of conversation around it at this time of the year.
Yeah.
It's breeding birds, of course, on the ground are very, very vulnerable. And when you're out and about walking your dogs, perhaps put them on a lead if you can at this time of the year. I love my dogs, don't get me wrong. I love to see them run and being playful and enjoying their lives. But I do put them on the lead when we go into a conservation area or a habitat for nature, because it's really important that we cause as little disturbance as possible. And then I take my dogs elsewhere to have a run around and have the time of their lives. So it's all about getting that balance right for birds and for us. Our dogs.
So that's it. That's the end of episode 7 of the Fox Blogs podcast.
It's going so quickly.
Going
my
really
goodness.
Really quickly. Now, make sure you vote on Twitter as to who you think did the best in our weekly fact off. Was it the deep sea sex fusion or the shallow sea sex confusion?
You're not going to let that one go,
no.
Are you?
I'm very proud of myself.
Thank you very much, everyone. It's been brilliant to have you along. Have a wonderful week, and we will see you next time. You are the Frog Spotters.